It's okay, we're here to learn Torah. I think we can get started. And it's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Silber, of course, the founder and director of Trisha, really the first place, I believe, for serious women's Torah education, really, probably in 2,000 years. I mean, I started in 1979. Now we so take it for granted. But really, Rabbi Silber is mamash the pioneer in this field. Started Trisha over 40 years ago, and now they opened up a yeshiva in Israel, and they're doing wonderful things, and it's always a pleasure to have him here at Torah in Motion. So, bakasha.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for all the good work you do in promulgating Torah in the States, in Israel, in Canada. Keep up the good work. Okay, so we have soon... Pesach is upon us, and of course the Seder Sedarim, and the instructions for the Seder are given in the Mishnah. So the Mishnah actually tells us in the last chapter of Pesachim, the Mishnah gives us instructions about what to do with the Seder. And what's interesting is in terms of what we say at the Seder, Magid as it's known, the Mishnah directs us to a parasha in the Torah, in the book of Devarim, Chapter 26, the prayer of the recitation of the pilgrim who brings the first fruits to the temple, the Bikurim, and that when the person brings the first fruits to the temple, there's a recitation which begins with the words Arami Oved Avi, and the Mishnah says one should read the whole parsha, the Doresh Kol HaParsha Kula, and engage in Midrash on the entire parsha. We don't actually read the whole parasha. We read the first four psukim of the parasha. We'll get to that. The fifth pasuk is that you brought us into the land. That's not part of our Haggadah. But at the Haggadah, we focus on the first, our Haggadah focuses on the first four psukim. And then we have the instructions, the Doresh Kol HaParasha Kula. We're actually instructed to do Midrash. I can't think of any other place in that tradition where the tradition instructs us to engage in Midrash. And the truth is that the Haggadah, whoever put the Haggadah together, nobody seems to know who put the Haggadah together, but in any event, the Haggadah actually gives us Midrashim. Clearly, the Mishnah's intention is that everybody at their Seder should be delving into the text, should be asking questions. It's not clear that Mishnah knows of any fixed text altogether. Midrash is typically a kind of Torah Shebaal Peh, but the Haggadah has supplied us with various Midrashim on these four psukim. There are about 20 or so Midrashic statements in our Haggadah on the four psukim of Arami Oved Avi. Before I move into some of the Midrashim that the Haggadah has provided us with, I will say at the outset that actually having a Haggadah with these Midrashim is a blessing, but it's also a challenge, because it's very easy to assume that once we read the Haggadah, and clearly that's not the intention of our tradition, just to read the Haggadah. That intention is to delve into it, each of us ask our own questions, or pointing things out, and the Haggadah is supposed to be a help in that respect. You know, it gives us examples of what Midrash looks like, but I don't think the intention at all was to replace our own thoughts with what we find in the Haggadah, but it's easy to fall into that trap. Once something is written down, it's very easy for us to just to read it without necessarily assuming we have to ask our own questions or point out certain things about the story in general and about this particular text in particular. In any event, before we get to the some of the specifics, I just wanted to discuss very briefly this idea of doing Midrash. What is the very unusual obligation or instruction that the Mishnah gives us to engage in Midrash? Why Midrash? Why not simply read the Parsha? The Korea Parsha. What's the Dorish Korea Parsha Kula? Now, I was thinking that the idea of Midrash is particularly appropriate for the Seder. The Seder, later on in the Haggadah, I'm sure this is quite familiar to us, the Haggadah says that, So in every generation, one should see oneself as if we personally left Egypt. And the Haggadah continues, Lo et avotenu bilvad, not only did God redeem our ancestors, avotanu galimahem, we were redeemed with them. And not only that, that's a statement that we find in the Haggadah, but even more striking is the blessing that we make at the end of Maggid. Now, there are four different blessings that we make, four times at the Seder where we have blessings. Those are the four cups of wine. The cups of wine are connected to other blessings, so that Kiddush is a bracha, and we say Kiddush over wine. Then we tell the story, at the end of which we have a blessing. Then we eat the meal, at the end of which we have Birkat HaMazon. Then Hallel, at the end of which we have another bracha. Each bracha is made over a cup of wine. Those are the four cups of wine at the Seder. So the blessing at the end of Maggid, it's a very striking blessing, very beautiful blessing. Brucha to Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam. It begins, Asher Ga'alanu V'Ga'alat Avoteinu Mitzrayim. Blessed are you, O God, who redeemed us and redeemed our ancestors from Egypt. So you see there the actual blessing. It's not just a statement in the Haggadah, but the actual blessing says that we bless God who redeemed us, Galanu, and also our ancestors. That's exactly what the Haggadah says prior to that. We're all redeemed. We see ourselves as if we personally had left Egypt. And of course, that's an interesting, how does one do that actually? So it requires a kind of leap of imagination to see ourselves as there. And one of the things I pointed out in this Haggadah that I wrote together with Rachel first, my student and colleague, that actually it's something very basic to the Haggadah, because the Haggadah, and we'll come to this, the Haggadah sees the Exodus as a fulfillment of a prior promise. In the Haggadah, we cite in the Haggadah the promise made to Abraham and the Brit Ben Abitarim that your descendants will be slaves and strangers and abused in a foreign land. Three generations, the fourth generation shall return to the land. The Haggadah interprets the story of the Exodus in the light of the promise. And when you think about the covenantal promise, this is so basic to the Haggadah, and when you think about the Brit Ben Abitarim, there's something very striking about the Brit Ben Abitarim. When God speaks to Abraham in chapter 15 of Sefer Bereishit, so God spoke of three generations and a fourth generation. There'll be three generations of suffering, being a stranger, ger, avd, inui, three generations. The dar rivi'i yashuv u'hena, but the fourth generation shall return to the land. And when you think about the Brit Ben Abitarim, which is the text that lies behind the entire Sefer, that's the covenantal promise. And the Exodus is a fulfillment of that promise. But what is in particularly striking is that when Avram was instructed in chapter 15 of Bereishit, he's instructed to take animals, take three sets of animals and to cut them in half, cut them in pieces, put them on either side. And then there's a fourth set, two birds, Yetat Sipar Lo Batar, but the birds were not cut. So presumably the animals that Avram takes are reflective, so we related to and reflective of the covenant. So what is the connection between the animals he takes and the promise? So what I suggested was that the animals that are cut in half, the three sets, represent the three generations of suffering. In fact, the animals, the carcasses, it says that the bird of prey descended upon them and Avram chased them away. As if to say, they're cut in half, but, and almost destroyed, if not for Avram, and Avram's, the covenant with Avram, God remembering the covenant with Avram, who knows what might have happened. But the fourth generation shall return to the land, those birds are not cut. Which means that what the covenant consists of is three generations that suffer, who do not return to the land, and a fourth generation which doesn't suffer, and does return to the land. It means the three generations of suffering, if one understands the covenant, you're actually suffering knowing that you're not going to return to the land. but you set up the possibility for the next generation to return to the land. And the covenant is a product of both. Both of those who paved the way with their suffering and those who enter the land made possible by the suffering of their ancestors. These two groups together are what we call the covenant. So on the night of Pesach, where we at the Seder are reaffirming this covenant, what is absolutely critical is the link between the generations, because the entire covenant is about a link between generations. And at the Seder, the Haggadah instructs us to imagine ourselves as actually there. And I want to just make one point. It's in my Haggadah someplace or other, but it's about 14 years ago. But the point is that the core text of the Haggadah, let's say Arami Yoveh Dovi, the Mishnah says we should read the whole parsha. But we don't read the whole parsha. We read only the first four psukim. The fourth pasuk says, "Vayotzienu Hashem Mitzrayim biyad chazaka," etc. In other words, we stop at the point of the Exodus, or the promise made to Abraham. The Brit Ben Habetzarim talks about the suffering. It talks about returning to the land. We don't read the whole parsha. We stop at V'achrechein Yetzu Berchush Gadol. We stop at when they leave the suffering. They leave with great wealth, which of course happens at Mitzrayim. We leave Mitzrayim, we're given all kinds of gifts. We don't actually tell the whole story. And part of that idea is, just imagine yourself as leaving Mitzrayim. We know the end of the story. We've seen the movie. But imagine you haven't seen the ending. And you're in Mitzrayim, and you're walking off into some desert. Yes, there are promises, but you walk off into the unknown. What would that be like to walk off into the unknown? It's not a simple matter to follow Moshe at God's instruction to walk to a place. You know where you're leaving, which is a bad place, but at least you know what you're getting. And you're leaving to parts unknown. So part of this idea at the Seder is to try to imagine ourselves as actually being there. It requires a flight of imagination. And that is, I think, very important. So the linkage between generations is something very important at the Seder. And that's the idea of Midrash. Coming back to the Midrash. Because what is Midrash actually about? What is Midrash assuming? The Midrash assumes that you have this ancient text. And the Midrash assumes that this text, this ancient text, can be a vehicle for our own understanding. Whenever we live, we have our own questions. We're living thousands of years later. We have our questions. The Midrash assumes that if you delve into the text, you can extract from this text responses, appropriate responses to the questions we are asking today. So the Midrash is an attempt, as it were, to bridge the gap between ancient texts on one hand and our own personal standing, our own place in the world, place and time in the world. And the Midrash tries to bridge that gap. The claim is that we can, in fact, extract meaning from these ancient texts. They remain relevant to us. And that is, I think, if you think about that, the Seder in general and the power of the Seder, you know, one of the children that the Haggadah calls a Rasha, I wouldn't call that a Rasha, but the point is, what is the relevance? That's the question. Okay, 3,000 years ago, we were saved. We have to turn our lives upside down because 3,000 years ago, we were saved. How is it relevant to us? And the fact of the matter is, you can call the questioner a Rasha, call whatever you want, but it's a very good question. And in point of fact, the Rasha and the Chacham at the Haggadah, at the Seder, are asking the same question. One has a different attitude. The Chacham says, I know there's a lot of meaning here. Could you explain it to me? And the Rasha says, what are you wasting your time for? But at the end of the day, they're fundamentally asking the same question. One assumes it's a good answer, and one is a scoffer, who presumes there's no good answer. But the question is the same question, which has to be addressed always. And at the Seder, we try to address it. And the mechanism, the vehicle, is that of Midrash. Okay, just want to say something about Midrash. I think there's a reason, I think, that the Midrash is chosen as the core vehicle to tell our story at the Seder. Now, let me stop you for a moment, and for any comments or questions, I will be happy to address them, and then we'll move on. And I'll also leave time at the end. We have a couple of minutes at the end. And if there are no questions, I'll just continue. I'll just go on, but you feel free to ask questions. Okay, so this is the mitzvah that we have of the Doresh Kol HaParsha Kula, and the text that the Haggadah has chosen is Arami Yoved Avi, the prayer of the pilgrim who brings the first fruits. Now, this particular choice is, I would say, at first glance, a very peculiar choice for two different reasons. First of all, the night of the Seder, we are telling the story of the Yetziat Mitzrayim. We are telling the story of the Exodus. The mitzvah, the Haggadah says the mitzvah, Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. Mitzvah, Olenu L'Saper Yetziat Mitzrayim. One might have expected, if the mitzvah is L'Saper Yetziat Mitzrayim, to tell the story of the Exodus, I would have imagined that the core text of the Seder would be from the book of Exodus, from Sefer Shemot. It's actually from Sefer Dvarim, which is very strange. And on top of that, not only is it from Sefer Devarim, but it's the prayer of the person who brings the first fruits to the temple. But the first fruits to the temple are not brought on Pesach. They're brought on Yom HaBikurim, which is the holiday 7 weeks away from Pesach. Shavuot is Yom HaBikurim. So it is a very strange text. But to add to the question, to make it truly strange, one might say bizarre, is that we have about 20 drashot over here. And the way these drashot work is that almost all of them, with a couple of exceptions, the Haggadah has these four psukim. It breaks them up into pieces. And in each piece, it has a kind of drasha. Most of them, almost all of the drashot, begin with the words, Kamosha Ne'emar, Kamosha Ne'emar. We're going to cite another verse to somehow explicate the first verse. Half the verses that we cite are from Sefer Shemot. In other words, it's actually, when you think about it, it's exceedingly odd. We're citing a psukim in Dvarim. Oh, as it is written in Sefer Shemot, and then we cite psukim largely from the very beginning of Sefer Shemot. So that is a unusual move, I think, that the Haggadah makes. And I think we have to try to understand it. Before I get to some of the specific drashot, I just want to point out something I think that's obvious to all of us, but I'll say it anyway, which is, when the Haggadah says, quotes a pasuk in Devarim, and says, as it is written in Sefer Shemot, the point of the Baal Haggadah, whoever this person may have been, who knows, but whoever it is, I'm quite certain, did not subscribe to the documentary hypothesis. In other words, the Baal Haggadah is not saying, it says something in Sefer Devarim, how do you know it's true? That's deep. How do you know it's actually true? Oh, but it says so in Sefer Shemot. That somehow validates the statement. That can't be possible. The Haggadah doesn't ascribe more weight to Psukim and Sefer Shemot than the Haggadah ascribes to Psukim and Sefer Devarim. So it's not to confirm that it's true. If it says it in Sefer Devarim, the Haggadah assumes that it's true. The Pasuk is not to validate. The Pasuk is to explicate. There's something about the Pasuk in Devarim that requires some kind of interpretation or explanation. Some question that can be raised, some difficulty, as Midrash typically works that way. And I think what's interesting for us as participants in the Seder is to try to figure out what might have bothered the Baal Haggadah and what the pasuk that's being cited actually adds to our understanding. So having said that, and there are about 20 such drashot, in the time that we have together, which is about 40 minutes, I would like to look at some of the drashot. I would start with the first pasuk, and I would say pasuk number one and pasuk number four. If we have more time, I'll try to do some more as well. Anyway, the Haggadah begins, this section begins with the words Tzeil Vamad. If you have Haggadah, you can see Tzeil Vamad. Go forth and learn. That was the name of my own Haggadah. Go forth and learn, Tzeil Vamad.
So
So the Haggadah cites the first of these four psukim, Arami Oved Avi. And I will say, if you think about it, I would call this exceedingly odd. Exceedingly so. I mean, here we are gathered on the night of Pesach to recall the exodus from Egypt. Not even to recall the exodus from Egypt, but actually to experience the exodus from Egypt. There's a mitzvah every single day of the year to remember the exodus. There's a disagreement in the Mishnah, which is found in the Haggadah. Is it once a day? Is it twice a day? But everybody agrees that at least every single day, one should remember the fact that we left Egypt. Even says so in the third paragraph of the Shema, Adi Hashem Elokeichem, Asher Hoteiti Etchem Me'aretz Mitzrayim. So the night of Pesach is not to remember it, but with saper, to study it, to experience it. So if you this is the mitzvah of the night. And Israel was redeemed by God. The villain is, of course, Paro, and the Egyptians that follow his lead, and the miracles that we experienced, which took us out of Egypt. So we begin the Haggadah in the following way. We're going to tell this story. You think Paro is something. Forget Paro. Laban is much worse. What? We're talking about Paro. We're talking about Yetziat Mitzrayim. I find that a strange way to start the Haggadah. Paro was a bad guy, but Laban was worse. What is that actually about? I mean, what is the point that God is trying to make? And as we have with many Midrashim, the Midrash often discloses a point, but the Midrash assumes many other things. When you're studying Midrash, when they quote a pasuk, I'll give an example towards the end of this little session, where the Midrash quotes a pasuk, quotes a word, but the Midrash wants you to look at the larger context. It's not just saying this word. What the Midrash often is saying is, you have to interpret one story in light of another. So but the story that the Midrash is pointing us towards as we begin our study of Yitziat Mitzrayim is Yaakov in the house of Laban. What the Midrash is assuming is that the experience of Yaakov in the house of Laban and the experience of Israel in Egypt are actually very similar experiences. Similar experiences. Now, in point of fact, the Midrash we have in the Haggadah doesn't actually explain how it got to that, interpretation. But it certainly invites us to open up the Chumash. And when you open up the Chumash, you notice something very striking about Yaakov in the house of Laban. First of all, there were all kinds of parallels between Yaakov in the house of Laban and Israel in Egypt. Many, many. But in particular, what is striking is the way that Yaakov himself describes his own experience. After 20 years in the house of Laban, Yaakov runs away. Laban chases after him. And Yaakov, Laban catches up with him and sort of threatens him. God already has told Laban, you know, be careful here. Don't harm Yaakov. But Laban accuses Yaakov. Why did you steal away? Why did you steal my gods? And he searches through all of Yaakov's houses, various tents, of Yaakov's tents, his wife's tents. Can't find the idols that Yaakov claimed that he stole. Rachel, in fact, had taken them. But at the end of that search, that invasion of privacy, one might say, Yaakov finally gets angry at Laban after 20 years. And in getting angry at Laban, he describes his own experience in the house of Laban. Two terms jump out at you in terms of Yaakov's experience. One is the word avodah, avadaticha, which I would interpret as I've been your slave for all these years. And the second is the word et onyei v'et yegia kapai. God has seen my avdut and my inui. Now, avdut and inui are two of the three covenantal terms when God speaks to Abraham. Avdut and Inui. Ger yezarecha b'yeretz vahem v'avadum v'inu otam gerut. Avdut and Inui. In talking to Laban in chapter 31 of Reshit, Yaakov self-describes his experience as Avdut and Inui. He might not have said that 10 years earlier, but that's how he sees it as he's leaving. Later in chapter 32, he sends messengers to his brother Esau, who's coming towards him with many men. Yaakov's afraid of him. And Yaakov sends a message to Esau, Im Lavan Garti, v'echar adata. I was a ger. I was a stranger in the house of Lavan, completing the triad of Gerut, Avdut, and Inui. And that same triad of Gerut, Avdut, and Inui appears in the first two chapters of Sefer Shemot. That's how the Torah describes Israel's experience in Egypt. And not only that, the triad of Gevurot, Avdut, and Inui, which appears five times in the Chumash, and one of the five times is within the parsha of Arami Oved Avi. Arami of Vayera Mitzrayim, right? Vayagar, you have in the first verse Vayagar Sham, and later you have Avdut and Inui in the second verse. So what the Haggadah notices, and there's so much more to say about this, what the Haggadah notices is that the experience of Yaakov in the house of Laban and the experience of Israel in Egypt are essentially the same experience. And that's very important for the Haggadah for two different reasons. Number one, because the Haggadah makes the claim later that this experience of being enslaved and being redeemed is an experience that has taken place often within Jewish history. We've had this often. We've suffered greatly. At the end of it, God has redeemed us. That's the claim that Haggadah makes. The idea that history is cyclical, that history repeats, and we begin the Tzeil Gemar by making the statement, you know something? There was an Exodus even before there was an Exodus. Yaakov in the house of Laban is already a kind of Yitziat Mitzrayim. That's one point. And I would add to this a second point, which is that for the Haggadah, it's not about history. It's not about studying Jewish history. It's about the interpretation of history. For the Haggadah, the importance of Yitziat Mitzrayim is that it actually clinches a prior covenant. Because that's the covenantal formula, Gevurot and Avdut and Inui. So the Haggadah is making the claim, the implicit claim, that the importance of Yitziat Mitzrayim is through this experience, this collective experience of Gevurot and Avdut and Inui, we have clinched this covenant with God. And it's a covenant within which we function. We are covenantal people. That is to say, we function within this relationship. And like all long-term relationships, there are many ups and downs. But at the end of the day, this is the formative event which coincides with the creation of the Jewish people. So that's how we're starting. There's Yetziat Mitzrayim even before we were in Mitzrayim. And of course, if one goes back to the Chumash, you will find all kinds of parallels between the story of Yaakov and the story of Israel and Egypt. And because you find all kinds of parallels, by the way, you also find all kinds of distinctions. Whenever there are parallels, there are also distinctions. In fact, distinctions can only be drawn when, in fact, there are parallels. So that's how we begin. Now, the Haggadah is making a kind of midrashic claim. It's v'doresh kol ha'parsha kula. The claim the Haggadah makes, which is a drush, it's probably not the best shot, but it is possible interpretation. The claim the Haggadah makes is that Arami Oved Avi, which could be interpreted as my father was a wandering Aramean. I believe that's probably the better interpretation. The commentaries are divided, but certainly a plausible reading is my father was a wandering Aramean who went down to Egypt. But the Haggadah interprets it differently. Arami is Lavan ha-Arami. Lavan, the Aramean, Ovei, would have destroyed, tried to destroy Ovi, my father Yaakov. That's the Midrashic reading by Yered Mitzrayim. And by the way, just to make a small point here, that actually, when you think about the verse, Arami Oved Avi Vayered Mitzrayim, when you read that pasuk, what it sounds like is, Lavan, pretend you know nothing about the Chumash, and you read this, sounds like Lavan the Aramean tried to kill Jacob, who ran off to Egypt. Doesn't it sound that way? Arami Oved Avi Vayered Mitzrayim. But of course, when you read the Chumash, that's not true. Yaakov didn't go from Lavan's house to Mitzrayim. Yaakov went to Lavan's house back home. He goes to Yitzchak. His whole story of Yosef. Yaakov goes to Mitzrayim in chapter 46. He leaves Lavan in chapter 31. But the Haggadah doesn't mean to say that he left from the house of Lavan to Mitzrayim. It's saying something different. It's saying Vayerin Mitzrayim. Yaakov, who dwelt in the house of Lavan and experienced that, experienced the same thing when he went down to Mitzrayim. The very pasuk itself suggests a parallel experience between Lavan on one hand and between the story of Israel and Egypt on the other. So that's the, now again, the Haggadah makes another claim in this first pasuk, which I think is probably also not necessarily the pshat on one hand, namely, Lavan is worse, says Lavan is worse than Paro. Paro only decreed against the boys, Lavan would have destroyed everybody. So first of all, I don't think it's true that Paro only decreed against the boys. I think the simple pshat of the Chumash is, as the Ramban suggests, should not be read as kill the boys, don't worry about the girls. But as the Ramban noted, keep them alive, is kill the boys and kidnap the girls. The same as the Ramban says we have when Avram goes to Mitzrayim. Avram's afraid they're going to kill me and they're going to take you. Which is worse, I can't say. But it's how we only decree against the boys. In any event, that's what but Lavan bikesh v'akor etako. Lavan is worse. Lavan would have destroyed everything. The Haggadah doesn't actually tell us how would have Lavan destroyed everybody. Does it mean would have killed everybody? Is that what it means? Is that the danger of Lavan? Or is the danger of Lavan something else in terms of the pshat of the Chumash? I think the danger of Lavan is that Yaakov is prone to become part of Lavan's family. Yaakov's behavior in the house of Lavan is very Lavan-like. He sort of out-Lavan's Lavan. Yeah, he learns to out-manipulate Lavan, but that kind of behavior is inappropriate for one who's going to be covenantal. As Yaakov himself says after he leaves, Im Lavan Garti, I was a stranger in that place. One does not get that sense when one reads the Chumash that Yaakov always felt himself a stranger. He was doing just great there. But the fact of the matter is, in retrospect, Yaakov, looking back, Yaakov looks back at the experience. Yaakov's greatness is to be able to reinterpret his own experience. And Yaakov says, Im Lavan Garti, that was never my place. That's what Yaakov comes to understand. Okay, so that's how we begin this series of drashot. First is Arami Oveda Viva Yerid Mitzrayim. Let me pick another couple of examples. Okay, I'll pick each example. There's a lot to say. Vayered Mitzrayim. He went down to Egypt. Comments the Haggadah. Onus al pi hadibur. Onus al pi hadibur. Compelled by the divine word. Here, the Haggadah doesn't actually cite a verse. Normally, the Haggadah, to get 18 of the 20 examples, they quote a pasuk. But here it simply says, Anus al pi hadibur, compelled by the divine word. Now, one could say that given the fact that we have just pointed out the parallel between Jacob in the house of Lavan and Yaakov in Mitzrayim, and Israel in Egypt, of course, one could say, why in the world would Yaakov go to Mitzrayim, given the fact that he's once experienced what it means to be in exile? Why would he put himself in the same situation, if not for the fact that God has demanded that Yaakov go? So maybe that's implicit. But I did want to add one thing about these few words, Anus al pi hadibur, compelled by the divine word. And I think what God is picking up is this. I'll read you the story of Yaakov going down to Egypt in chapter 46 of Bereishit. Yaakov goes down to Egypt. He discovers that Yosef is alive. He wants to see Yosef before he dies. The family's headed down to Mitzrayim. And when Yaakov is heading down to Mitzrayim in chapter 46 of Sefer Bereishit, he goes to Beersheba. He brings sacrifices to the God of his father, Yitzchak. Yaakov, Yaakov, and God calls to Yaakov, Yaakov, Yaakov. And God said, Anochi el Elohei Avicha, I am the God of your father. Al tira midam Mitzrayimah, ki gadol gadol asimcha. Don't be afraid to go down there. You will there become a great nation. The nation is built in Mitzrayim. The same way Yaakov's family was built in the house of Lavan. The nation will be built in Mitzrayim. And the next pasuk, Anochi eredimcha Mitzrayimah, Anochi alcha gam alo. I will go down with you, and I will bring you up. So what the Baal Haggadah noticed, what the Midrash noticed, is the repetition of a word. One of the ways the Chumash expresses its meaning is by repetition of words, often three times or seven times. Here we have a word that is mentioned three times. What is the word that is mentioned three times? The word is Anochi. Anochi Elohei Avicha, Anochi Eredimcha Mitzrayma, Anochi Alcha Gamalol. Comments to God, why did Yaakov go down to Mitzrayim? Anus al pi hadibur. Al pi hadibur. Remember what the Gemara says about 613 commandments? There are 613 commandments. Torah, Tav, Vav, Resh, Hey, is 611. Anochi v'lo yelecha mipi adibur shimon. Anochi and lo yelecha, that was the pi adibur. Anus al pi adibur. What the Haggadah notices is the triple anochi. Yes, of course he was compelled by God's will. But God says to Yaakov, this is part of my plan. I'm going to go down with you. I'm going to bring you up. You'll be there till you die. You're not going down temporarily. But this is the divine, when Yaakov accepts it. And I would say this is a very important point in the Torah, that Yaakov understands what he's in for. He doesn't just happen to suffer. He knows what it is to go to Mitzrayim. He knows about the Gerut and the Avdut and the Inui. He knows what's going to happen, and he still accepts it. Yeah, he sets up the covenant for the future generations. He is the third generation, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Only the fourth generation shall return to the land. So the point is, he's setting up the future. That's the Anochi. That's the Alpi Adibur. Okay, this is the first drasha. Let me spend the remaining time on the last drasha. This is drasha number 1 and 2. And we'll skip over the next 16, 17 drashot. And let's get to the last drasha. The very last drasha. So the last drasha is the last pasuk. The last pasuk talks about God taking us out of Mitzrayim. Vayotzieinu Hashem mi Mitzrayim, v'yod chazaka v'zmor nutuya v'mora gadol uv'yotot uv'moftim. So the Haggadah actually quotes the fourth verse. The Exodus stops here. It doesn't talk about coming to the land. And on each of this, on this last pasuk, it breaks it down into pieces. And there's a drush on each of the pieces. The very last drasha, uvamoftim, the last word, God took us out uvamoftim with wonders. And the Haggadah made the following comment. Uvamoftim ze adam. With wonders, this refers to the blood. Kemosha ne'emar, as it is written, and we cite a verse. V'natati moftim bashamayim uva'aretz. Dam va'esh v'timrot hashem. Okay, it talks about, right? Talks about blood and fire, right? Smoke, whatever. Timrot hashem. That's a pasuk from the book of Yoel. And this is the last drasha. I remember the Haggadah we used to use when I was in my parents' home many years ago. And for whatever reason, the printer decided this is a very important pasuk. So Dam Esh and Timrot hashem were in big print. The printers decide what's important or not. So Dam Va'esh v'Timrot Hashan is in very big print. In any event, big print or small print, what does it actually mean? What does it mean, Zeh Adam? With wonders, this is the blood. What blood? So in thinking about Dam, thinking about blood in the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, so some of the commentaries assume Zeh Adam refers to the first plague. The first of the 10 plagues was Dam. With wonders, this refers to the first plague of Dam. That's what many of the commentaries suggest. I have a difficulty with this interpretation. I don't think it represents the best interpretation. I think that it's problematic for the following reason. Of course, in this very pasuk itself, Vayotzieinu Hashem mi Mitzrayim, he says, "Biyad chazaka v'zroa natuya," with his powerful hand, outstretched arm. "Biyad chazaka v'zroa natuya." So, what does the Haggadah say? "Biyad chazaka zadever." This refers to the plague of pestilence, the fifth plague. Kamosha Emma, "Hine yad Hashem hoyab miknochashe basadeh basusim b'chamorim uvagmalim dever b'vakor v'tzom dever kovein mo'od." So Biyad Chazaka refers to plague number 5. There the Torah uses the word Yad. It is true. Yad Hashem Oyab Miknecha. And what is Zro and Tuya refer to with the outstretched arm? Says the Haggadah Zo Acherev. This refers to the sword. And we cite a verse from Divrei Hayamim. Charbo Shvufa Biyado Nituya Ayerushalayim. What does that refer to? That's the story where King David takes a census. You're not supposed to count the people. And in the version in Divrei Hayamim, God sends a plague against the people, and the avenging or destroying angel is above the threshing floor of Aravna, the place that will become the temple site, the Beit HaMikdash. His hand is stretched over. Netuya Yerushalayim. Charbo shufa biyado. It said the angel had a sword in his hand. So Charbo Netuya Yerushalayim. So Zeroa Netuya, says the Haggadah, Zoacherim. Now, these are two drashot of the Haggadah. Another question is, what is the Medrash saying over here? What is the Medrash saying? That Biyad Chazaka Zoadever and Zeroa Netuya Zoacherim. So I think what it's saying is very simply that Yod Chazaka and Zro and Etuya refer to the 10 plagues. Because Dever is plague number 5, and Cherev, which of course is Makat Becharot, is plague number 10. The Torah never tells us how in fact God killed the firstborn. The Haggadah suggests was some kind of plague. Cherev, in the case of the Pasuk, is not Cherev. But actually, it's Dever. God sends Dever when David takes the census, so the people die by Dever. So there's Dever directed against the animals, that's plague number 5. And there's a Dever, which the Haggadah calls Cherev, directed against the people and the animals, is plague number 10. So Biyad Chazaka uVizro Netuya, the Haggadah is claiming, refers to the 10 plagues. Now it's claiming much more than that, and there will be a whole separate shiur. Why, in fact, it calls the story of King David's census. But let's have to leave that for now. We can't do it. But my point is, the Haggadah has already referenced the 10 plagues. So Moftim can't be Dam, because Dam is simply the first of the 10 plagues. We're beyond the 10 plagues. The Dam here does not refer to the Dam of the 10 plagues. The Dam refers to something else. Because the truth of the matter is, when we think about the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Dam appears in 3 different places. The Dam appears as the sign that Moshe is to demonstrate before the people who don't believe him. And God says, I will give you signs. The third of which is take some water, throw it on the ground, and the water will turn to blood. The second time we have Dam is the first of the 10 plagues. First of the 10 plagues is Dam. But then we have Dam in another place. Not in terms of the plagues, but rather before we can leave Mitzrayim. The thing we have to do before we can leave Mitzrayim, we can't leave until we do this. Before we can leave Mitzrayim, we have to bring a sacrifice, Korban Pesach. And we ought to take the blood of the sacrifice, says the Torah, V'yigatem oshtei hamezuzot v'yoham hashkof. We ought to place the blood of the sacrifice on the doorposts and on the lintel. That is to say that the very doorpost and the lintel become a kind of altar. The house becomes an altar. And this is the blood that's of the sacrifice. And the angel will see the blood and pass over the house or protect the house, depending how one interprets Pesach. I don't think it means that, oh, I see there's a red spot over there. So that's a house that we don't go into. That is a possibility, certainly. But I think it means more than just that. It means that I will pass through the land of Mitzrayim on that night, slaying the firstborn. But those of you who have prepared a sacrifice to replace as an act of substitution, which is what sacrifice often is, it's an act of substitution. So the blood of the sacrifice will act as a substitute for the people inside the house, the firstborn, maybe for the others as well. That's the idea of the dam. And now we quote a pasuk from the book of Yoel. Dam va'esh v'timrot hashan. It's not a pasuk. It's just 3 words. So what the Medrash expects us to do, I don't know how many of us actually do this, what the Medrash expects us to do is to open up the book of Yoel and to read it and to see what the Medrash might be getting at when it talks about the Moftim Zahadam. So let's take a look at the book of Yoel, chapter 3 of Yoel. Book of Yoel starts, by the way, with a plague. That's where the book of Yoel starts. similar to the plague of Arba, the eighth plague. Let's take a look here. Yoel. Here's how chapter 3 starts. Treyosar, to define Yoel, which is, one second, please. Where can I find Yoel? Where are you, Yoel? Let's see. What's the beginning of Treyosar? Somehow I can't find it.
Hosea, Yoel, Amos. It's right after Hosea.
It's right at the beginning. Yeah, I have it. Right. So it's chapter 3. Right. Chapter 2 is about the plagues, etc. Chapter 2 talks about some kind of restoration. And then we come to chapter 3 and chapter 4. Vayachare Kain. Right? The previous pasuk says, Vidatem ki bekerev Yisrael ani. Ani Hashem Eloichem. V'eino od. V'yevoshu ami li'olam. My people shall be shamed no more. Now we have the prophecy, sort of end of days prophecy in the book of Yoel. This is what the Haggadah points us towards. Afterwards, Eshpoch et ruchi al kol basar. I shall pour my spirit upon all flesh. And your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your old people will dream dreams, and the young people will see visions. It talks about prophecy. Not only will the young people and the old people see visions, not just the older people, the younger people, the daughters, the sons, even the male and female slaves, Avdechem v'shivchotechem. In those days, I will pour my spirit upon them. Probably this is the verse that's being referenced by the famous statement when we crossed the Red Sea. See, it reads, Masheros Ashivcha Rayom, Laroy Yecheskel Ben Buzi. But the maidservant saw at the sea, Yecheskel, great prophet Yecheskel, did not envision. Yecheskel saw the vision of the chariot. But the slave woman at the sea saw more. This is what it says over here. The end of days, there'll be prophecy. God will be manifest. God will be revealed. The old people will have dreams and the young people will have visions. And now the text continues. And I will make great and I will make wonders, right? Portents, they translate, in the sky and on earth. Dom va'esh v'timrot ashan. These are the portents. That's what the Medrash is referring to. And that's what the Haggadah refers to. On that day, at the end of time, when there's this great revelation, and there's a prophetic response, there will be in that day portents in the sky. Right? And on that very day, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. Hashemesh yapech uchoshech, the sun shall become dark. Eclipse, solar eclipse. Hayareach v'dam, lunar eclipse, right? The moon turns red, right? Lifnei bo yom Hashem hagadol v'hanorah, before the great and awesome day of God. V'ayah kol asher yikra b'shem Hashem yimoleik, ki b'har tzion yivrushalayim tiyeh pleita. Kasher Amar Hashem, uvasridim Asher Hashem korei. But anyone, right? Who can escape this great and terrible day? Whoever invokes the name of God, there will be a remnant on Har Tzion and in Yerushalayim. Anyone who invokes God will be among the survivors. This is what the Haggadah is pointing towards. This is the point of the Haggadah in the last Russia. The point is this. God will appear in Egypt at that time. The presence of God, we know from our study of the Tanakh, is very dangerous. If you're unprepared for God's presence, it's an overwhelming presence. As Jacob said, how does one survive the divine encounter? There are several ways. One is through sacrifice. Of course, God accepts my substitution. But over here in the book of Yoel, it's not so much about sacrifice. It's about creating a safe and sacred space, which for the book of Yoel is Yerushalayim, is Tzion, creating a sacred space. In the land of Egypt, there was also a sacred space that we created. It was the Bayit. The blood on the doorpost marks off the house from the rest of Mitzrayim. Yes, what's happening is in Mitzrayim, but even in Mitzrayim, we're not part of Mitzrayim, because we have marked off the space. It becomes a holy space. It becomes a space of sacrifice. It's a place where one serves God. In other words, for the Baal HaGadah, the point of the exodus from Egypt, we began by saying, you know what? There was an exodus even before we were in Mitzrayim, Yaakov in the house of Laban. But the last drasha is saying something different. The reason this event is so central to us is because it's a paradigm for the future. Because this is the way we can live as a nation and live in God's presence, which is a great gift, but also a great challenge and can be a great danger. Not if you're prepared, not if you create a sacred space. And this is the sacred space of Mitzrayim. This is the Korban Pesach. And you can't leave Mitzrayim until first you've created the sacred space. And in the future, there will also be a sacred space. This is the great vision of Yoel. It's a great and terrible day. Dam va'esh v'timrot ashan. These are the portents. But at the very same time, the presence of God affords an opportunity for deeper understanding. In those days, the world will be filled with God's knowledge, as the seas cover the earth. But it's creation of this space. And that's why we celebrate Mitzrayim. It not just is about our past, and not even about a past prior to Mitzrayim. It's also a portent and a hope for the future. So this is a simple example of a drasha, of what Midrash is doing. And of course, the Baal HaGadah expects all of us to open up the book of Yoel. And when you read it, it becomes very clear that the dam is not the dam of the plagues. No, it's the dam of the doorpost, which signals that this house is separated out from, is separate from the rest of Mitzrayim. Let me stop here for a moment, or more than a moment, and take any comments. I see there are a bunch of comments and questions, so I'll try to respond to them in the remaining time.
You see the comment, Anus al pi ha-dibur.
Yes. Anus al pi ha-dibur?
Yeah, that's Gershon's comment in the chat box. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me start with Joyce. Could love and arm be a euphemism for another country?
Well, I don't think it's a euphemism for another country. I think that God is suggesting, I don't think it's specifically Lavan. In the Chumash, it's the story of Yaakov and the house of Lavan. But I think the Haggadah is about Jewish experiences. As the Haggadah says, it happens many, many times throughout Jewish history. No matter where Jews have found themselves, and we found ourselves in many, many different places, and often as a small minority who wants to stick to their beliefs and their practices, that was not taken necessarily very kindly by the host nation. So I don't think that it is to be seen specifically as Lavan. In the Chumash, it's Lavan. But I think for the Haggadah, it's actually any place where Jews have found themselves. And often, not always, but often, it was not with some very very harsh harsh response by the host nations. I don't think it's only Lavan. Chumash, it's Lavan, of course, yes. What was the question about Anus al pi ha-dibur?
All right, I'll read it for you. Anus al pi ha-dibur is not explained by the Pasuk in Bereishit, which mentions Anochi three times to explain where Jacob goes to Egypt, encouraged by God. This paradoxical omission corresponds to the paradoxical omission of the name of Moshe.
Well, here's the point about Anus al pi ha-dibur. In the Chumash, let's leave out what I said. What I was simply pointing out, I think for the Medrash, the language of the Medrash, Anos al pi ha-dibur, that the Medrash is basically pointing us to the word Anochi. Because the word Anochi in our Talmudic literature, rabbinic literature, Anochi is a pi ha-dibur. That's what we heard directly from God. The Rambam talks about that at great length, about that everybody has to believe that God exists, and that there's only one God, the way the Rambam describes it. And, you know, how much we heard Har Sinai for the Rambam is a good question. But this everybody has to know. Even the one who comes, even the convert has to be told for the Rambam these two basic principles of faith. It's me, that's Anochi, me, al pi adibur, or mi pi adibur shmanu. I think in the Chumash, the pshat is clear. I mean, the Chumash is making it very, God says to Yaakov, this is my plan. I know it's difficult to go down there. I know you don't want to stay there. I know it's going to be hard, but do what I tell you to do. Accept what I tell you to do. And Yaakov already says Hineni. Hineni is always found in the Chumash when you're given a very difficult task, whether it's the Akedah, whether it's Yosef being sent to his brothers, Moshe at the snare, to take on a mission that Moshe initially does not want to take on. He fights it to some degree. At the end of the day, he does say Hineni. And he accepts it. So I think that the pshat is very simply, for this we don't need the al pi ha-dibur necessarily. What God says to Yaakov is, don't be afraid. He is afraid. But I'm going to be with you. I'm going to go down. And by the way, just derech agav, I would make the following observation. That when Yaakov leaves to the house of Lavan, where does he leave from? Vayetze Yaakov mi Beersheba. He leaves in Beersheba. The first time Yaakov goes into exile, he leaves from Beersheba. And when he wakes up, it says, Vayira Yaakov Ma'od. And in the vision, he sees the angels of God, Olim Biyordimbo. That's the first time he leaves the land. And the second time he leaves the land in chapter 46, he goes to Beersheba. He goes to Beersheba. And he's also afraid. And God says to him, Anochi Eredim Chom Mitzrayimo, V'Anochi Alcha Gam Alo. The two stories are exactly parallel. The first time he goes into exile, and the second time he goes into exile from the same place with the same response. And God's response is the same. The difference is that in the first instance, there are only angels going up and down. But the second time, God says, Anochi Eredim, I'm going to go with you. Anochi Alcha Gam Alo. So there's a sense of comfort to Yaakov. At the same time, as I said, he knows what he's getting into. He's not unaware of it. And that's very important, I think, for the Chumash, because it means that Yaakov knowingly accepts this burden of the Gerut Avda Tuninu. He has no illusions about the experience in Mitzrayim. I will just conclude with the following thought, very briefly, which is this. I said this many years ago. I'll repeat it now. I actually like it very much, so I'll repeat it, which is this. When Yaakov blesses all his sons at the end of Sefer Bereishit, each one is... Some get a better blessing, some get a more problematic, but Yaakov, everybody's included. Shnei Masar, everybody's included. In the middle of his blessings, when Yaakov is blessing his children, he says, Yishuatcha ki v'si Hashem. It's one of the great puzzles. What does that mean, Yishuatcha ki v'si Hashem? Why is it, what's it doing here in the middle of these blessings? So I saw several of our Israeli friends talk about that Yishuatcha ki v'si Hashem is a marker which makes the point that that's the middle point of the blessings, and there are parallels between what comes before and what comes after in terms of the structure, in terms of the mivneh. That may even be true, but it hardly explains the words Yishuatcha ki v'si Hashem. I can fully accept that it works for what is Yishuatcha ki v'si Hashem. So I have the following suggestion, and with this I will conclude. Before we should also kibisi Hashem, the child, the son that Yaakov is blessing is done. Don yadin amok yachad shiftei Yisrael. Don shall avenge his people, right? As one of the tribes of Israel, one of the leading tribes. He don nocha shal derach shififona leorach. He's a snake along the road. Hanoshechik veisus vayipolach v'achar. He bites the horse and the rider falls off. So he talks about Don, the tribe of Don, saving the Jewish people, saving or avenging the Jewish people. And Yaakov stops. And Yaakov says, one second. Here I'm talking about Acharit HaYomim, but who's going to save the Jewish people now? we're already in trouble. No one else knows that. Not his sons, who are very happy to be in Egypt, who never think of leaving, who have Achuzah there. Everybody else is very, except Yaakov. Yaakov understands what it means to go down to Mitzrayim. So Yaakov turns to God, and no one understands what Yaakov's saying, because they wouldn't even know what he's talking about. What do you mean redemption? We're doing just great. We have preferential treatment. We have protection. What are you talking about? We should also keep Yisri Hashem is Yaakov's prayer to leave Mitzrayim. And the Chumash says later on, it's exactly true, right? Because it's Shirat Hayam, what do we say? Shiru Hashem ki go'o ga'a sus rochvo ramav vayam. The horse and the rider are thrown off. That's what Dan does. Hanoshech ikvei sus vayipol rochvo achar. And Yaakov said, we should also keep Yisri Hashem. And the Shira, what does it say? Sus rochvo ramav vayam ozi vizimras ka vayhili lishua. Shuto shamikra, my friends. Of course, it's true. It's a prayer and a prophecy of the future. And the point is, it's a prayer and prophecy no one could possibly understand except Jacob. Because only Yaakov understands the truth. He knows what going down to Mitzrayim means. Not his children, nobody. Maybe Joseph at the end of his life understands it, at the very end. But till that point, he didn't understand it. Only at the very end, Yaakov teaches Yosef, and Yosef says, we have to get out of here. Because this is not our place. Yosef is the first slave. We need a Yetzias Mitzrayim. So Yaakov is actually praying for Yetzias Mitzrayim. Yaakov is prophesying Yetzias Mitzrayim. He's reminded, why is he reminded with Dan? Because the covenantal promise is about Dan. That's the point. Yaakov knows the promise. The nation which enslaves them, I will be done. So Yaakov says, you'll be done. We need that right now, God. Yes, done in the future, we'll be done your din. But what about Achrei Don Anochi? What about God being done, the ones who enslave us? Which is Mitzrayim. We should also keep Yisri Hashem, oh God, redeem us from this slavery, from this avdus. And of course, that's what happens at the Ozi v'zimros ka v'hiyu Yishua. I wish everybody a chakosh v'sameach. Thank you to Rabbi Kelman for all your good work and for inviting me. Look forward to participate in the future, Drisha and Torah in Motion. It's a good partnership. Thank you very much.
I agree. Yeah. And I always like your creativity, that thought about that, really quite fascinating. I never heard anything similar. Very, very nice. Thank you very much. I look forward to learning with you. Tomorrow we have a doubleheader. At 1 o'clock, Moshe Shulman, Rabbi Shulman will be giving a class on Where Was God During the Exodus. And then at 2:15, Dr. Rachel Cooperman, who is an art historian, just got her PhD in Jewish art history, will be giving a class on the evolving Seder plate from an artistic point of view. So that'll be back-to-back tomorrow at 1 and 2:15. In between, we'll have our regular Monday night shiur, Mark Shapiro, tonight on the Musar dispute. That will be at 8:15 tonight. And then Wednesday, Ariel Kelman, I know him well, will be making his debut on Torah in Motion, giving shiur hardening, Parva's heart. Thursday, Adina Blaustein on Shabbos HaKadol HaFtorah. It's also all at 1 o'clock. Friday, my shiur at 9:15, instead of being on the Siddur, will be on the Haggadah. We'll pick off where we left off last year when we did in the Haggadah. But you'll have to come and find out exactly where. But we'll go through the Haggadah Friday morning. And then Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag will be giving a shiur. And I think Monday morning, we'll also have a little wind-up, a little few things to say at the Seder for those who can make it on Erev Pesach a little bit. Okay, we look forward to seeing you soon. Please invite a friend. I will. You should get an email in the next half an hour or so that the recordings from our Yom HaYun yesterday, they're already posted up. I'm going to send out an email now after this class. And the audios and videos from really are, I think, a great moving Yom HaYun. Our nine speakers going through our Gana. Rabbi Silber, you got the advantage to speak for an hour. All our speakers complained that they only got to speak for half an hour. But there are pluses and minuses to everything. Yay, Eilu Ve'elu, Relim Chaim. So the Yom HaYun is, you know, back. This is more relaxed. Yashar Koach, and we look forward to being Yashar Kasher V'Smeach.
Thank you, and Chag Sameach V'Kasher.
Okay, yes. Chag Sameach V'Kasher. Okay, very good. Okay, everybody. We'll hopefully see you. For good things.
Bye, Tevin.